I'm Kieran.
And I'm Eve. This is Kitchen Table Cult.
We're two quiverful escapees talk about our experiences in the cultish underbelly of the religious right. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Kieran.
How are you?
Well, it's way too warm where right now where I am for this time of year, but I'm really enjoying that.
That's fair. I just got back. We're recording this the weekend I got back from Portugal for my birthday. So I saw sun for the first time in months.
It was happy birthday.
So
good.
So I'm like, ah, I feel alive again. It's not gloomy and the sun has set after 5 p.m. So we're out of the winter. It's nice.
Yeah. No, I'm very excited. Like, started doing garden chores this past weekend. Feels very, really good to get out there and do that again. But we're not here to talk about garden chores.
No. We're very excited to have a very cool person joining us today to talk about her book. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hello. And happy birthday, by the way, Kieran.
Thank you.
Why would I know that? I don't really know you. But
now you know that.
Now I do. Happy birthday. I'm Sarah McCammon. I am the author of The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. It's out March 19th from St. Martin's Press. I'm also a political correspondent for NPR, and I have found myself kind of accidentally covering the nexus of religion and politics, including a bunch of stuff I grew up observing, and that's part of what the book is about. So
yeah. Yeah, I imagine it feels, I don't know if you wrote this anticipating that this would be coming out during another Trump-Biden election year, but must feel strange to have this starting the year off.
I didn't know for sure. I mean, there was always like the kind of maybe, right? But I started scribbling away notes for this book idea right after the 2016 campaign. Definitely did not envision what 2024 would be like. It took me a while to really get to a place for a variety of reasons where I was ready to write the book. And I did several revisions of a book proposal. Mm-hmm. And so I think about the time I signed the contract for it in like late 21, early 22. And so it was becoming more and more clear where things were headed. But no, like when I was conceiving of the book idea, I had no way of knowing what we would be looking at this year. And in fact, I was worried I didn't want the book to be too much about Donald Trump, because while the Trump moment was, a pivotal sort of catalyzing moment in some of these conversations that ex-evangelicals have been having with each other about the world they grew up in and its role in creating the world we live in now. It's about more than that. And mm-hmm. So, I was thinking hard about the balance to strike there. But we are where we are.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, like, the time frame you kind of focus on. And I kind of want to go back to your comment about the book proposal and then ask about the timeline. But first, is this the book that you sold originally? How did this change from like what you were originally trying to sell to publishers versus the actual like final version that we have here?
I would say it's pretty close. I had I was lucky enough to have two offers, and the other publisher, I don't think wanted to do this book. And then I had a couple other publishers sort of interested, but one didn't really get the concept. And that's fine. Like, St. Martin's totally got the vision, the concept, which is really an interweaving of my story with stories of other people. And that was what I wanted to do from the get-go, because I did start, I'd had my own journey, which a lot of us, I think, will recognize with the White Evangelical Church and my own experience of trying to make sense of it and make sense of the outside world, figure out who I was and wanted to be. And that happened, I'm in my early 40s, so that happened a while ago. And I really had not identified as evangelical for a long time. But in and around the 2016 campaign, on the one hand, I am, as a professional, writing stories about white evangelicals and their support for Trump. I kind of accidentally got assigned to this. Like, I had been a local member station reporter at three different NPR stations, had covered politics some, had done some national work for the network, and then got recruited to be part of the campaign team in 2015, leading into 2016. Got assigned to the Republican primary, figured I'd be covering like Jeb Bush an awful lot, spent some time. Yeah, remember that guy?
Oh, man.
spend some time with like Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina. You know, there's some blasts from the past. And it, of course, it all wound up being all about Trump. And so I find myself like writing these stories about what are white evangelicals going to do? They're such an important part of the party base. Why do they like Trump? And I'm thinking about my childhood through all of this and like thinking about all the political discussions in my household and the people that we looked up to and the values that they espoused. And, you know, it was a little bit of a weird position to be in, but I had really distanced myself from that world. And I didn't think about it, you know, I didn't think about it really as a conflict so much as in some ways I'm like, well, I have some insight into this culture. I right. know the theology and the political philosophy behind a lot of what's going on. So I felt like I was kind of able to ask, I think, the right questions and sort of anticipate what people would say. And so that was kind of fascinating. But then I started seeing all of these conversations unfolding online, you know, around this question, especially among younger evangelicals, adults who had grown up in the same world that I'd grown up in, going, wait a second, like, how do we make sense of this moment? And I think it just, I don't know if you observed the same things I observed, but I was just seeing what felt like kind of a Pandora's box being opened up, and people were talking about, you know, not just Trump, but science and the relationship between the church and women and LGBTQ mm-hmm. people and a host mm-hmm. of other issues that all kind of felt in a way tangled together. And so I wanted to write about that and through the lens of somebody who knows this world, but also in conversation with lots of other people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we would agree with what you observed in that little span of time. Do you feel like, so you centered this book on like your story in terms of timeline, like it's your story is like the through line that everything else is hung on. Do you feel like that limited you from like including certain things that might have been further back that might be significant as well? Or do you feel like this was like a really good box for it to exist in?
I mean, if you want to talk about evangelicalism, you could go back. What?
Yeah, that's so, 1,000 years. Yeah. I, as a writer, keep going like, oh my God, let's just start the Reformation. Let's just start with like, you know, the translation of the Bible. Like,
I mean, I'm reading a book right now very slowly about like the history of conversion, mostly forced conversion. Mm-hmm. And it looks at Islam and different sects of Christianity mostly. But yeah, like you could go back to Constantine if you wanted to.
Right.
And so that was something I did struggle with a little bit, but I felt like the memoir-ish frame helped me kind of contain it. And I do kind of feel like I was born at a really pivotal moment. I was born in literally 2 weeks after Ronald Reagan was sworn into office. And so I watched through my childhood the whole kind of like rise of the moral majority, the, you know, kind of escalation of the anti-abortion movement, the reaction of the white evangelical movement to Bill Clinton and his moral mm-hmm. failings, which all kind of formed an interesting bookend to what happened with Trump. Mm-hmm. So it felt like a natural, kind of convenient and natural infrastructure for the book. I tried for like I did not go deeply into like, you know, the Great Awakening or the fundamentals and, you know, the early sort of like intellectual underpinnings of the evangelical movement. Like I touch on it and then I move on because one, there's a ton of amazing literature out there that's done that already. And I didn't want to reinvent the mm-hmm. wheel. And two, you know, I was able to draw from some of that existing literature and I tried to do it strategically in ways that kind of like, okay, let's explain what evangelicalism is and sort of the intellectual universe or spiritual universe that I was growing up in and a lot of us were growing up in, and then sort of move on to like, let's really look at what that was like. And I wanted to talk about leaving it because I think the sort of question that hangs in the air a lot is, why don't people leave these movements? Why do they believe this way? Why do they get stuck in them? And mm-hmm. I think you kind of have to understand what it's like to be inside one in order to understand, one, why some people don't leave and why it can be so hard to leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I also feel like earlier when you were talking about like you kind of left and hadn't really thought about like the past and stuff until like the 2016 election happened and then it all came back. I feel like for a lot of us as sort of the first-ish generation or like cohort of people who like grew up Fundy in like the height of the purity culture moment and then left, like the Obama years were like the key, like the prime, like early deconstructing phase. And then by the time that President Trump happened, it was like, I thought I left this. What the fuck is it doing in my face? Why is this happening again now? But like on a national scale, I thought we collectively got over that shit, and then it just wasn't. And now it's all like front and center again.
Yeah, it was a little surprising. I think I was honestly a little bit surprised to see the evangelical movement rally around Trump. So I don't know if I should say willingly. There was some coming around, but not that much, really.
It was less than I would have thought it would have taken. Like, I mean, I grew up listening to Rush Limbaugh and stuff because my dad was a construction worker and that was on the radio all the time. So, like, I listened to all the right-wing talk show hosts and, like, all of the, like, right-wing, like, radio pastor people. And it was just, like, even for me, I was like, how does this square? Like, why? And I expected more resistance from the, like, hardline evangelicals than wound up actually happening, which was very disappointing, even though I'd been, like, out for many, many years at that point.
Yeah, and I think it was... I don't know. You drew the connection to the King David story and like and the difference in how the evangelicals reacted to Clinton versus how they reacted to Trump. And Kristen Kobe DeMetz also talks about that in her book, The King David Analogy, of like, yeah, God will use a fallen leader to achieve his will. And I think that's often what it comes back to, is like because we were inside it, could see the like accumulative years and years and years of like putting up with pastors who were not using their power well and who were, you know, harming people overtly or by protecting predators. And like, even though all of that was not stuff that we like in the evangelical movement, like overtly endorsed, like it was such a like open secret that when you got someone like Trump there, it was like, you either have to like clean your own home or accept this guy.
Mm-hmm. And I think there was, you know, sort of a habitual tendency to accept the words of a strong male leader. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of part of the culture.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes I look back on 2016 and I remember being really surprised, and other times it was like, well, it's not that surprising, you know, and it's kind of both in different ways. It's sort of, and I think it's like, if you dig a few layers deeper, which is why I love Kristen Kobes-Dumais' work and her, you know, the way she sort of looks at the militaristic themes and the tendency to feel embattled, she and others have written about really well over, you know, many years. It's not a new idea, but I think it's a really important one for understanding the moment we're in. Because I did hear that in my reporting too, this idea that, you know, Trump is a fighter. He's not, maybe he's not a good guy necessarily, or the guy that we want to be like or hang out with, but like he's a fighter and he'll fight for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that is what so much of it came down to for so many evangelicals, the sense that the culture had shifted under their feet. They no longer had dominance over what was considered expected, normal, valued, you know, and that was deeply destabilizing. And they saw Trump as sort of a, I don't want to use the word savior, but someone, you know, the hero that would save them from
Yeah. Well, there was that whole moment in the Trump administration where he was like, but I am the chosen one. And we were like, dude, please, please no.
I think you also hit on something really unique in this book that I do not see enough people talking about, that I think is a really big piece of all of this, is the anti-intellectualism in the evangelical movement. And I think that's part of what made Trump acceptable, is, you know, he's savvy but not smart. That kind of like attitude is what the anti-intellectualism like allowed for a lot of pastors to get into roles of leadership with that same kind of mode. You had the like Jesus movement, like people are leaving like the established denominations and like, you know, taking on leadership roles in churches without going to seminary. And it's just like, God called me, I'm empowered, I'm equipped, and all of that. And it's basically the same recipe.
Yeah, being I guess, charismatic, and I'm not using the theological
but sense that charming, of that word. Yeah.
Yeah, being charismatic could be a substitute for being credentialed. Remember I had a pastor that I remember mentioning at a football party. He had not finished college. And I just remember kind of, I was in college and my jaw kind of dropped, you know, because I was actually at a college that had an evangelical seminary attached to it. And so it wasn't as if the entire movement devalued education, but even where education was valued, it was sort of narrowly constrained what was considered acceptable knowledge, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I went to this evangelical college with this big seminary campus across the street, and yet the professors were sort of curated, hand selected, and you know, our science professor spent time explaining why she didn't believe in evolution. And you know, there are, I mean, you can find people who believe those things, and evangelical institutions tend to do that, I think, because it protects a larger intellectual, or I think you could say often anti-intellectual framework, because, you know, there is this sense that you start sort of questioning one thing, chipping away at one thing, and other things will follow. And for a lot of people, the truth is that they do. So.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about the history of the anti-intellectualism and how you like chose to make that like a theme that you focused on?
Yeah. I mean, again, going back to my own childhood, like I remember my parents taking me to this seminar at church when I was very young. That was all about, I think it was, and I write in the book, like I was so young that I'm not sure who was speaking to us, but it was pretty clearly a Ken Ham sort of product, or at least Ken Ham's, the creation scientist,
Was it Kent Hovind talking about how you need a boy and a girl baby dinosaur?
I don't remember the baby dinosaur.
But that's, we've been doing some research for another project.
For the about baby, I don't think baby dinosaurs can make baby dinosaurs.
Well, he said they could.
Well, he said that would come into play later. He didn't really go into much more detail.
Got it.
It's just a clip that we found that like, It was weird.
So funny.
But one of the, I think they did talk about dinosaur either in that course or somewhere along the way. I remember very clearly being told that, you know, humans and dinosaurs live together, which of course is contrary to mainstream scientific thinking by a lot, but that, you know, there were, I think they showed us on this overhead projector, they showed us like these pictures of footprints. And this part of my memory is from a long ago. So I'm not 100% sure about this, but
these guys were a dime a dozen.
I do remember something about dinosaurs and the idea that dinosaurs and humans had coexisted. They had to, because according to the Genesis account, they'd been created together. Mm-hmm. And I remember like someone, maybe it was my Christian school teacher, pointing to the book of Job where it talks about the behemoth, and the behemoth was supposedly a dinosaur because it was like a big beast.
Right.
So, you know, growing up, I had seen through, you know, textbooks in my Christian school, the seminar at church, you know, magazines from and books from Focus on the Family and Christian radio and Christian movies and Christian television. There was this whole carefully constructed world that was designed to cause you as a young person growing up within it to think a certain way and to protect you, shelter you from certain kinds of what I would call forbidden knowledge, to go back to my earlier point. And I, you know, I write in the book that I almost, when Kellyanne Conway, Trump's advisor, got on TV and started talking about alternative facts, it kind of stopped me in my tracks, because it was like, I know about alternative facts. I mean, I remember, you know, many years of sort of hearing the adults around me just absolutely insist. I mean, I'll keep going back to evolution just because I think it's a really good example.
It's the easiest. Yeah. Everybody's familiar with this. It makes a lot of sense.
It's, I mean, and it's something where there's an overwhelming scientific consensus by people of all kinds of faiths and religious beliefs, except for many, many evangelical Christians, you know, who again, have been sort of sold this kind of mini industry of creation science, quote unquote, that teaches something that's completely contrary to like what virtually all experts in the world understand to be the case. And when you undermine knowledge and learning and inquiry in that way, I think it opens the doors to, you know, it's a really sort of chaotic intellectual paradigm, because who then do you trust and who then mm-hmm. has authority? If mm-hmm. it's not somebody with who studied and learned and gotten an education, but it's somebody who's charismatic, if it's not somebody who has spent, you know, their entire career looking at fossils, but it's somebody who's, you know, studied the book of Genesis and has a theory about how it all happened. You know, I think it's hard to know who to trust at that point. And I remember coming out of that as a child feeling very confused about kind of which way was up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think you see it now in, you know, efforts to restrict access to certain books. And, you know, and I don't want to weigh in too much to those because those are policy debates. And I'm not saying that every single book that's ever been published should be available to like 5 year olds.
No, but like the organizing efforts that those groups are using has its like, is a replication of the model that was used to deregulate homeschooling and to like assert these like parental rights extremist ideas. And so it's definitely all connected.
And I mean, what it does is I think the way it functions is it undermines the legitimacy of institutions and authorities that yeah. might cause a person, especially a child, to question religious authorities.
Yeah. Which is like why you see in these groups, like the anti-vaccine mythology so alive and well, and like those kinds of other things that you, once you just decide that you're not going to trust science in XYZ way, then everything else becomes called into question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and I write in the book about the fact that white evangelicals were, I think, the group with one of the highest rates of vaccine denialism and refusal, to the point where even people like Franklin Graham had to kind of get out in front of white evangelicals and say, hey, guys, you know, we need to do this. This is for our own good. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's been a lot of good, really, I think, fascinating research by scholars like Ruth Brownstein, who I also cite in the book, looking at the overlap between people who sort of hold evangelical beliefs and also are, I mean, there was sort of like, I think one study I cited showed a sort of an inverse relationship between holding those beliefs and having a good grasp of, you know, certain basic historical facts. And, you know, that's something that I think that it's not, certainly not true of all evangelicals, but it's something that evangelical leaders, I would think, should be concerned about.
It mm-hmm. is absolutely a trend that should be something that's taken seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it all, for me reading about it and thinking about this in sort of like a kind of zoomed out organizing lens, is the evangelical right has been creating like a dual power structure since like the 80s, before that even, where like they literally do live in a different reality than the rest of us do. They have their own news, they have their own media, they have their own doctors, they have their own like ideologues, they have their own religion, and it is very like, if you grow up in that, or if you get, you know, pipelined into that one way or another, you are very, very quickly surrounded by just a ton of information being screamed at you that isn't true, but you lose all of your like social connections and social standing and like sort of community the minute you start asking probing questions. Mm-hmm. Like, I got all these creation science books growing up, homeschooled, and I was not interested in science for a very long time because the books were just like, it is this way because God said so. There was nothing to feed my curiosity until I like got out and went to college.
And it's such a like an intense experience of once you subscribe to the ideology, once you subscribe, not ascribe, to the ideology, the community is prefab provided mm-hmm. for you. And leaving becomes very difficult because you don't know how to rebuild that community, because it's not just being handed to you as like an entire like unit like it is in the evangelical underworld.
It's really true. I mean, I describe it in the book, as others have, as a a parallel universe. And I think Kieran, you were just kind of alluding to that, but it is, it's, you know, there's a whole alternative, I think you said alternative authority or something like
it's
that.
It's an alternate parallel power structure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's, and it starts with the sort of alternative intellectual power structure, but you're right, Eve, you step outside of that. And I mean, it's interesting the ways that these communities kind of police themselves. And I'm sure you've seen that, but like some of it's through, a lot of it's through, of course, authority figures, you know, warning you about what the world will tell you when, if you, yeah, you step outside the line. But some of it also, I mean, I think I was part of that. My peers and I were part of that. You know, you would whisper about somebody who wasn't walking with the Lord or.
Yeah. The white women in this universe self-police and reinforce everything and they are really active in doing that.
Mm-hmm. I think I touched on that a little bit in the book too, when I talk about purity culture, the ways that, mm-hmm. you know, even like I relate like one conversation that I had in my college dorm about sex and where I basically acknowledged that like I wanted to have sex someday.
How dare you?
With my husband. Oh my gosh, right? Like how dare a 20-year-old college student be horny, right?
Wow.
I mean,
Ooh, whores.
Yes, the shock and horror on the look of some of my classmates who, you know, one of whom at least has deconstructed since then, because that's how it was. But at the time, you know, it was like even just acknowledging that you had sexual feelings was kind of taboo in that world. And in that room, there was no adult, there was no pastor telling us like, cross your legs, ladies. It was us telling each other, you know, you better not think that way. You better not.
Everyone is deputized to be a modesty cop or a purity cop.
And it's, you know, it's seen as like an act of love. Like you're looking out for someone by being like, hey, your shirt's too tight, or like, you know, go change. Or
I can see
like,
your clavicle.
Yeah, like, oh, your shoulder is out. Like, you know, oh no, someone's ankle is showing. It's really messed up, but it's very, it gets to be self-policing really quickly because it's so insular, as soon as someone is not accepted, they're ostracized. And it's very, like, it's just as jarring for people to watch it, and it's jarring for people to experience it at the same time. So it's not something anyone wants to experience, because no one, it preys on like the most human tendencies in our yearning for connection, right?
And I was just thinking, it's not that different from the way secular groups of people behave, right? I mean, In you could probably make an analogy to like how mean girls behave in high school, and like if somebody wears the wrong thing, but it's there isn't the overlay of modesty and spirituality. It's just like, well, that's not cool, or that's not in. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a similar kind of mechanism. Can I ask, did you guys go to public school or Christian school or homeschool?
We were homeschooled. So yeah. Well, Kieran was a founding member of, and I am now a board member of, the Coalition for Responsible Home Education.
Oh, that's right. I have seen that.
Yeah. So we're very involved in the make homeschool safe. It doesn't need to be deregulated like it is now conversation, because we both had, you know, those educational neglect experiences to very different degrees. But yeah.
Yeah. As I write, I went to Christian school, which was maybe slightly more, slightly less sheltered, but it was also very restrictive. We had pretty strict dress code, along gender lines, of course. So boys could come to school in pants and run around, but girls had to wear dresses. And I remember in elementary school, always wearing shorts underneath because we wanted to be able to play on the playground, and you couldn't do the monkey bars in a skirt.
Bike shorts.
No.
Bike shorts all the time.
Yeah. Yep. Which, you know, it's funny. Like, I like dresses. Not everybody does, but I actually like dresses. I enjoy that performance of femininity, or whatever you want to call it. I don't like to wear them all the time, but I wonder sometimes how, like, I think about how restricted I was as a kid, and the boys didn't have that, you know? They could run around and play on the playground and get sweaty. And that's a small thing, but that was, you know, from a very young age, they were kind of telling you what your place was. And more significantly, I write about the fact that our textbooks came from you know, institutions like Pensacola
yep.
University, yep. Bob Jones University. And I go into a lot of detail in the book about some of the language around gender, around race, mm-hmm. around American history. You know, these are a lot of the books that existed in my school were kind of proto-Christian nationalism. I mean,
yep.
this framing Absolutely. Of America as this specially chosen country that God had given this favor to, and, you know, a real glossing over of the way that Native Americans were treated or of slavery. I mean, it was touched on, but I think if you read the book, it was touched on in a very inadequate way. And I think some of the language around the United States and its supposed role in the world really kind of foreshadows some of the conversations we're seeing in the public square today around Christian nationalism.
Well, just to take it like a very immediate example, one of the like situations that I can see very differently because I've had to reteach myself all of these things would be today the Supreme Court ruled that they're not going to overturn Colorado's
or their Trump can be on the ballot.
Yeah, Trump can be on the ballot, and a state does not have the authority to keep him off the ballot because it's a federal campaign. And like oh, you didn't notice yet, Kieran? Sorry.
It was a unanimous decision, though.
It was a unanimous decision, and everybody is really mad about it. And I'm like, but you have to understand, if they allowed it, it would be going back to the states' rights stuff.
Yep.
Which is not something we want to see happen, because that it would be feeding into the problem. And this is actually like a ruling that I don't like the outcome of, but I agree with the reasoning for. And I know that because I've had to like readdress all of the history that I learned about the Civil War was about states' rights versus federalism and like federal overreach, like, which is total bullshit, as we all know. But like, I had to do all of that work. And now I'm like looking at this and I'm being like, this, there's a line here. There's a connection here.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's what a lot of things will come down to, I think, in the years to come, a question of like, are we willing to advocate for democracy and our system, or mm-hmm. are, you know, do we prioritize the system or just getting the outcome that we want today? And I think that is a question that like all Americans need to ask themselves,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was fascinating that decision was unanimous because for various reasons, all the justices said this is not a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering how that would pan out because yeah, like, it's because it is a federal election issue. You really can't have the states do it and stuff.
You can't have the tail wagging the dog. Yeah, you have to bring this up to them. If you're going to take this to SCOTUS, it should be as a federal question, not as a mm-hmm. state question.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, there are reasons. This is a complete sidebar. I'm sorry. I did not read. I'm just so back sorry. From vacation. I did not read the news today.
Bring that in.
It's all right. We were just talking about that on our podcast. So it's all good.
But like, yeah, you can't do it that way. Like the question about whether or not Trump should be on the ballot is a question that should be asked because there is legitimate constitutional reasons for him not to be on the ballot, but it can't be done by way of Colorado leaving him off the ballot. That's not how you get there from here, which yeah, that could be an entire episode in itself, but
it's just like, being able to like parse that is a direct result of like how we got taught and how we had to correct our education on what we got taught.
That's true.
It's just very interesting to me to like watch a lot of public school people like responding to that being like really angry. And I'm like, no, you don't want that.
Some of you didn't take Mike Ferris's con law course and then have to reteach yourself con law and it shows.
Was that you?
That's me. Although honestly, I did it at the same time because I took his class and also had the original documents and also like had other sources that were not Michael Ferris about like the context in which the Constitution was made and how America came to be. So I was like, those things don't match up, Mike Ferris, but go off, I guess.
Do you all feel like there are I mean, I fully agree that I have gaps. Some of them I just described when it comes to like my understanding of history, definitely science. Mm-hmm. But do you feel like there are things that like you look back and you're like, that part of me came from my background, but I like it. Like, I'm glad that I'm me in this way, however I got to be this way.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yes.
I mean, because I do, but I'm curious.
Well, there was this one year in high school where my mom had twins and they were infants for that whole year. And I did not do shit for college. Sorry, high school, not college. I didn't do any schoolwork, really. Also, I'm just loving that your dog is popping up.
Your dog says like, hello. It's beautiful.
It's very cute.
This is Bailey. She's a rescue. She's half, what is she? She's half boxer and half, I'm blanking on the other one. The giant one.
Great Dane.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Dane. I was going to say, she looks like a Great Dane. So for good listeners, what we have is an armchair that looked empty. And then there was a giant dog that sat up.
The dog just sprouted. It was great.
And she's like the same color as the chair almost.
It's very cute.
So good.
But it's, yeah, I feel very safe with her in the house because she is mm-hmm. so big and so scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so back to high school. I guess just that year I just read books. I had a list of like classics of English literature that I had found somewhere, probably like on a Sunlight, you know, ordering list or something. That's a curriculum company. And I just read 300 books that year.
And that's a lot of books.
It was a lot of books. And so like I'm coming to college as an English major and everybody's like, oh no, I have to read this like 500 page book that I've never read before. And I'm like, I'm doing a reskim because I read it already.
Was that, yeah. Was that also the year that you had like the book review podcast?
No, that was the following year.
It was the following year.
But yeah. Yeah.
Did you go to Christian college?
Yeah. I went to Grove City College. So,
okay.
You know, deep Presbyterian Christian college won't take federal money because they don't want to be under Title IX. Silliness.
Well, that's something really specific. I like that. I was going to say, I think generally, like, I feel that because of the way I grew up, I was taught to think about big things, you know? I was mm-hmm. taught to, like, ask. I was taught to self-reflect, sometimes to a point that was traumatic and, you know, ad nauseum, and sometimes I need to shut the brain off. But mm-hmm. I think overall self-reflecting is important for humans to do. And also just to like, to think, to care about like, why are we here and what are we supposed to be doing while we're here and how are we supposed mm-hmm. to treat people? Like I've come to some different conclusions about those answers than perhaps I was taught, but I still think the questions are good ones. So that's something that I appreciate.
Kieran and I talk all the time about how, like, we got out because they raised us to ask hard questions and to evaluate yes. the, like, the veracity of arguments and the authority of the sources. And
all that. I learned to do my own research and come to my own conclusions, and I don't understand why they don't understand why I'm the way that I am. I did exactly what they had told me.
They did this.
One of the things I think that I most appreciate about like my background is just that like when I'm really good at like if I feel justified and like what I am doing is the right decision for me, I'm really good at standing in that and not really caring about what other people mm-hmm. think about it because I was primed to be like I was groomed to accept my own unpopularity. So like I don't care if I'm popular or not, if I'm like living authentically and doing the things and advocating for the things that I care about, because I was told that people were going to hate me for doing whatever. So it was shocking to me when I came out as queer and trans and non-binary and like agnostic and everything and like continue doing the work that I'm passionate about. The people like didn't hate me and people did like me. So I was like, oh, I was not prepared to be liked, but I am very prepared to like take a stance that may or may not be popular because I'm like, this is the thing that is right for me to do.
That makes sense. Which, I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric about being willing to stand alone, right? And
right.
I think there might have been like a Patch the Pirate song about that. Do you guys remember Patch the Pirate, or was that too worldly for you?
I did not get exposed to it, but I know who it is because I have a lot of friends who were really into it.
There might not have even been that song, but somebody had a song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember it being a big theme in VeggieTales too. And I was just yeah. I mean, I will, you know, do the things that I think are right. And then it, you know, can cost me my entire family. But here we are.
Speaking of you talk about an experience that I really relate to, just like the fear of your parents' reaction when you're announcing that you're divorcing.
Oh, yeah.
That was a big thing for me. And that, like Kieran said, like I was like bracing myself to lose my family because that's how it works in this world. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
That's been a tough one. You know, it's been a tough one. I haven't lost my family. All three of my siblings were at my wedding, my second wedding. Mm-hmm. My parents were not. So, and I don't go into everything in the book that happened there because I did have to talk about them and in order to talk about my childhood. And I felt like there was kind of enough about them as it was. I let them read everything about them and I did not let them change things, but I took their feedback back into account. But ultimately, you know, I made decisions about what I thought was salient and included that.
Yeah, that's fair.
But when it comes to the divorce, yeah, I mean, that was very, it was a very, what I will say without getting too detailed, because some of those details I just decided not to put in the book, is that it was a very, very difficult time. And it's gotten a bit better. It's been a few years now. And I was in a car accident in September, pretty bad one. And after that, my parents came up for a couple of days and spent some time with us, including my husband and I. And it was really the first time that they'd spent meaningful time with him, and it was actually a really healthy visit. And so I was really encouraged by that and I appreciated it. It does kind of make you wonder why was it so difficult to get to that? You know, like why did there have to be all the in-between stuff that wasn't so pleasant? But I realized that in their belief system, getting divorced was bad enough. Then when I told them I was seeing someone else, it was even harder. And, you know, I know what they believe about that. And I have always said, I respect those beliefs, that you're right to have them. But it would be, you know, it'd be nice to figure out how to carve out a space to just have like a relationship that just exists in its own space that isn't sort of overlaid with like, here is how I feel about your decisions.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's been more difficult at times.
Yeah. Yeah. It has been like, there is a really big division in my family that happened around the time of my divorce. And it basically came back down to my father's response was theological. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my mother's response was, you're my daughter. What do you need? Mm. And that's what it came down to ultimately. And has dramatically changed the trajectory of everybody's lives.
Mm. Yeah. It's tough, but you know, a big theme of my book, major character in my book is my grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also something I related to a lot. I have an aunt who is gay, and we've always known she was gay. And I think there's a lot of overlap in how my parents handled that to how your parents handled that.
And in many ways, the way they handled him was a precursor to how they handled my divorce. Different situations, but in both cases, it was just sort of like a life choice, life reality that was so at odds with their belief system that it was very difficult for them to get past their feelings about it. And you know, and that just, more than anything, it makes me sad. But I think that in talking with lots of other ex-evangelicals for this book, I know that we're not alone, that, you know, these issues, whether it's around sexuality or relationships or even just theological beliefs, these issues of, you know, adult children who have very different views of the world than their parents. However, honestly and earnestly we arrived at them, it's very painful for those parents, and navigating that is like so difficult.
Yeah.
And everybody navigates it different ways.
I mean, we talk about it a lot, but I think a lot of people who are, and I think your book handles this pretty well too, is like explaining like just the cost of leaving this environment, of leaving the religion, because it's so easy for your whole identity to be wrapped up in it, is so high. And that's what keeps people in for so long. And I think I'm glad to see that coming to the forefront in books now, with your book and with Sarah Stancorb's book, Disobedient Women. That's like a big part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. There is just like, there is, and even, is it Ginger's book or Jill's book? It was one of them.
Jill's book.
Yeah. Dark. Also talked about like, well, I mean, hers was literally called Counting the Cost. So,
yeah.
But it's just like, this is why the cost is so high. The stakes are so high, because it's not just like your in-person community, like your family, your local church, but it's also your like spiritual community and your spiritual like foreverness that may or may not exist after you leave evangelicalism.
And also just like going back to your grandfather, one of the things that was a sticking point for you was like, he's this academic, intellectual, like super, super smart man, like clearly credentialed in all these various ways. And like, you talk about how you tried to puzzle over like, how could someone so smart not see the truth of what we believe? Mm-hmm. And like, when you get to the other side, you're on the receiving end of that. Like, people start questioning from when you leave that world, people question your judgment. They question like your authority and the veracity of what you say you know, and like how you interact with facts. And like, so you can be presenting all of these things that like got you out, but because you're not ending up with the same conclusion, suddenly you're not a trustworthy narrator.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, it was like, we were told that, you know, he had hardened his heart, or that Satan had blinded his eyes, or all of these things, you know. And it was always really, I mean, my grandpa's existence throughout my childhood was like this tremendous foil for everything that I was being told, because it's like, I always knew that out there, there was a different way of seeing the world. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was warned about like the dangers of a sinful lifestyle and of being apart from God. But, you know, you're right. My grandfather was like probably the most accomplished person that I knew. And he was also the symbol of rejection of God. And so it was really hard to make sense of that. And I don't think, you know, I don't think most people have quite that stark of a foil in their, yeah. And so for me, that was like a really profound, like source of cognitive dissonance. And ultimately it just kind of became, it's certainly not the only thing, but it was a big driver for me to try to figure out like what was really going on. You know, I just yeah. wanted to really try to understand like what's true. And I still have anxiety about it sometimes. I think like, you know, I sometimes worry, like, can I trust my own mind, my mm-hmm. own heart? But I also know like how many years I spent like praying and begging God to like speak to me and mm-hmm. guide me and help me see the truth, you know? And I still pray like that. And I don't know if you guys are religious at all anymore. Sorry. I'm from the Midwest, so I say guys for everyone.
You're good.
Oh, yeah,
you're
same. Good.
I don't mean good. To gender you.
What? No, I grew up enough in California that yeah. that's how I see it too.
Y'all, like, y'all is nice and gender neutral, but it's also like not really mine because I'm not really yeah. Southern.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know how you all feel about that, but I, you know, I still feel like I ask if there's a God or a higher power. Like, I want to try to get it right. I really want to do the right thing. But like, just swallowing the evangelical, you know, program was just something I really couldn't do and be honest with myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're raised outside of like Calvinist circles, the ability to lose your faith is something that like is always held up as something to be afraid of. And like, if you have such a huge ideological shift where you're like, oh, suddenly I see the world differently and all of the things that I thought I knew aren't true, and I have to relearn an alternate reality to make sense of the world, there's always this like creeping sense of worry about like, what if I got it wrong this time again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I guess if for those who are raised Calvinist, it's like, well, I'm screwed or I'm not screwed. It doesn't really matter. But yeah.
There's a certain element of Zen to it I appreciate.
Yeah.
Yeah, my family was like non-denominational Assemblies of God. So like very much, yes, you can lose your salvation by some unknown third unforgivable sin. We don't fucking know. It could be divorce. It could be being gay. It could be just disagreeing with whatever my parents' biggest issue that day was. Who knows? But I never understood the like Calvinist, oh, you know, I either am or I'm not, and it's fine. You talked a bit in your book about getting kind of hung up on the what about the people who never heard about Jesus? Like, what the fuck happens to them? And that was a big thing for me that I was never actually really allowed to express. But mm-hmm. that was a huge like piece of angst of like, that's just like a huge population of the world to just go to hell for like through no fault of their own. Like, how do I square that cognitive dissonance? It's such a process to kind of get through. So I definitely, sometimes when I'm really anxious, I do like, I pray to the universe or like whatever exists outside of me, like the energy, the vibes, whatever, you know, I'm just like, please, whatever, you know, let this work out. Or like, cause I just like the thing that I miss about praying, even though I'm not religious, is just the like sort of offloading of my anxiety. And when I realized that that's what I was doing with praying was just like taking the anxiety that's spiraling in my brain and in my body and just like offloading it to something else, someone else, then I'm like, okay, I just need to like get this anxiety spiral out of my brain and I'll just put it on whatever seems fun today. So, and that like helps my brain a little bit, but it took a long time to kind of like get through the existential dread of there.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, people I talk to for this book, they wind up with all different places. Some people end up in progressive Christian communities and other people end up wanting very little to do with religion, if anything, you know, finding more community in like yoga or art or chosen family or whatever the case mm-hmm. may be. Something I talked about that was just kind of refreshing for me is in my second marriage was my husband's Reformed Jewish, and I had never really been to a synagogue before. You know, I'd been to a variety of Christian services, but not really anything else, which mm-hmm. I'm embarrassed to say.
That's a really common experience. I related to this too. Like up until I got out, I also hadn't been exposed too much.
Yeah. And it was interesting because like, I didn't, you know, I kind of went in when my husband and I were dating, like he told me he was like, not that religious, but he liked to go to the High Holy Days or whatever. And I was like, that's fine. Like I was like, that's great. Good for you. I'm mm-hmm. supportive. But I found that going with him to some of those services, you know, going through the ritual and the liturgy and all that stuff that was sort of familiar in some ways to some Christian services I'd been to, it felt like familiar and also different. Felt a lot less loaded, a lot less mm-hmm. baggage because it wasn't my tradition. It was somebody else's.
Yeah.
And the parts where, you know, like on the High Holy Days where you like Yom Kippur, and I'm probably going to get some of this wrong. So, but you know, the prayer and repentance is also part of course, the Jewish tradition. Christianity mm-hmm. comes from Judaism, but it was like interesting and refreshing for me to kind of see a different approach to it. Like you can go to a synagogue and pray and talk to God and, you know, that's fine. And I felt to the extent that I felt anything in church, I have felt that in synagogue. And I think mm-hmm. for me, that was kind of reassuring, like not that it means anything objectively or factually, but for me, it was like, okay, well, these responses that I have had in spiritual situations, these desires for some kind of connection, I've always struggled with those feelings. I've never quite known what to do with them. And I've never felt like I felt as much of them as I should. But to the extent that I experience them, I don't only experience them in an evangelical church, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Those are very, very human. Like we crave that community. We crave that like ritual. We crave that like beauty. We crave that ability to worship and to like come together and hold reverence. And so being able to like approach other religious services and environments and like practices with an open-mindedness, like really allows me to feel a lot more like at peace with like the things about my like culturally Christian self that have stuck, and not be so like hung up on like, well, I do not believe in this anymore, but that's okay. It like fills a role, it fills a void, and this is like a medium for expressing this part of me that is very human. I love that.
Yeah, because if one thing is pretty obviously true, it's that humans all over the world and all of throughout time have tended to do this spirituality thing, like reached out for something. And most of them we've come to a variety of different conclusions and expressions of that, you know? And I think if I place my faith in anything, it's the idea that, you know, if there is a good God being out there, that somehow all of that is loved. I hope so. You know, I really hope so.
I think that's a great note to end on. I did want to like talk about the research process of your book more, but like we've used up a lot of time. So I'll just say like reading this book was like creating a reading list for myself of books I hadn't heard of yet, which I was really excited about. So go check it out. Yeah. I'm really glad you came and talked to us. I'm really glad this book exists.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Tell us about, one, when it comes out, two, where can people buy it? That is not Amazon, and anything else that you want people to know. Where can they follow you if you want people to follow you, et cetera?
It's out March 19th. It is available all the usual places. Like, we have a landing page.
Everywhere books are sold.
Everywhere books are sold. Yeah, yeah. Not just that one place, but including that one place.
Definitely pre-order. Pre-orders are the best way to help authors.
Pre-orders are very helpful. It's called The Ex-Vangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church by me, Sarah McCammon. Sorry, you had one other question, Kieran. What was it?
Where can people find you?
Find me? Oh, yeah. I'm on lots of socials, but Substack is great. My Substack is free. I periodically write about life as a journalist and this or that, other things that I'm doing. And I guess Instagram is good, too. Sarah McCammon_journalist.
Okay.
So,
awesome.
Thank you.
We'll put those in the show notes.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us. I was really excited to read your book, and it's very interesting watching the writing or reading the writing of things that happened that like I lived through. And I'm like, oh yes, I remember all of those moments.
Yeah.
I was there when that happened. So thank you for writing about the things.
Well, thank you. And I do think it's fascinating that people are starting to sort of, there's a real coming of age of our generation, defined loosely. And people have a lot of things to say.
They really do.
Including you. So thank you for saying them.
All right.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. You know what to do. Like the episode, share it. Give it stars. All of the stars. And we'll
several
see.
Stars.
Several stars. Thank you. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to the Kitchen Table Cult podcast. Our music is from the track Janet by the band The Heavens on their album Stenazzo. Our producer is Dave the Great. Our podcast is made possible by Patreon donations from listeners like you. To support us and join our community on Slack, check out patreon.com/kitchentablecultpod. Thanks for listening.